At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you something extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound, on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, I'm Steve Coolby from The Church, giving you the story to Under the Milky Way on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. In this week's episode, I interview Steve Kilby, singer, songwriter, and bassist of great Aussie indie band The Church, who recorded one of the most beautiful, atmospheric, and enduring songs of the 1980s, Under the Milky Way. The Church released their first album in 1981 and achieved early critical and commercial success, but it wasn't until their fifth album, Starfish, in 1988, where they really broke out with Under the Milky Way, a song that Kilby wrote with his then-girlfriend in a matter of minutes in order to escape drying the dishes for his mom. Yes, it's true, and it's another case where an artist's most iconic song just flowed right out of them, almost in a moment of divine intervention. Yet Kilby didn't think much of the song at the time. He recounts it all together with his entire journey as an artist with a relentless and restless mind and with great candor and humor. It's a fascinating ride. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the Church's iconic, mystical, and timeless track, Under the Milky Way, with singer, songwriter, and bassist Steve Kilby.
Steve, founder of the band, singer, bass player, songwriter, and the really interesting part of it to me, because Steve, I followed your music from the very beginning, that 27 albums, studio albums, which is a hell of a lot of albums. You just released an album in 2023, The Hypnagogue, but you just released another album earlier this year. So
a companion album for The Hypnagogue, yeah.
Yeah. And you have
And 27, could I say 27 albums is underestimating. It's more like, for The Church, it's more like about 35 or 36, because there's a load of albums that people don't necessarily include. And there's there's a couple of albums we did acoustically. There's a couple of albums of outtakes, which are actually better than the outtakes are better than the albums in typical Church fashion. There's a lot of other albums as well. So it's really, 27 is okay to say that. I don't mind that. But there's really more like 36, 37.
Which even adds to the point. I would say you're very prolific. It's amazing. And now add another third to that. But good for you.
And I've got about 40 solo albums. If you like the church, you'll like my solo albums too. But they've been very hard to find. But we're gonna rectify that and get all of my albums, all of my solo albums, my collaborative albums and stuff. We're trying to get it all out there. So, yeah.
Well, Steve, so let's jump to that. When you have so much music, is this something that's just a daily, it flows out of you? Tell us a little bit about your process, and to be able to birth all those songs is pretty remarkable.
I've been obsessed with music my whole life. My dad was a musician. I've been obsessed with music. At age 16, I actually got a bass guitar and taught myself to play. I've been sort of writing songs ever since. Things took a really good turn in 1977. TIAC released the first domestic four-track machine. And before that, you couldn't really record at home. I used to do really atrocious stuff with two cassette players and, you know, all that. TIAC released this machine where a guy like me could sit at home and make his own records and do all the overdubs and stuff. So then my songwriting took an enormous jump, and I've written thousands of songs. I write when I need to. Like, months might go past and I might not write a song, and then someone will say, hey, let's make a record. I've never had writer's block. Like, the church just made a record. We just turned up, and for 2 weeks we wrote like 30 pieces of music, and then the band go away, and then I just sit down. I come in the morning and I write words and I come up with the melodies. And I don't know how it works. I don't know where it all comes from, but I am tapped into it. Whenever I want it, it's there. When I'm doing something I don't love or something I don't believe in, it won't work.
You create when there's a need for it, but do you ever have a moment where you wake up because there's a song that's in your head?
There are songs in my head all the time. I'm always thinking of songs, and I just let them all be, and I let them percolate. I'm very much a believer in something Paul McCartney once said. He said, if you have a song in your head, he said, let it be. That was an unintentional. Let it percolate. So I did. Songs do come unbidden into my head every now and then, and I just let them be, and I go, okay, next time I'm looking for something, you'll be there, and either it will or it won't. Every now and then, I've got a sort of a dutiful girlfriend. If I was to write a song, she would pull out if I said, look, I have written a song for no reason, she'd pull out her phone and film it.
Well, that's pretty amazing that it comes that easily for you, that you can will it into action. And there's so much.
I'm just going to say, that's all I'm good at in this whole world. I'm not really good at much else. And I've sort of specialized to a point. I've specialized my life where that's all I'm good at, and that's all people expect me to be good at.
It must be pretty amazing to have a song like Under the Milky Way that has just entered the collective consciousness and lives on for decade after decade after decade. Like, that's a pretty remarkable feat in and of itself, apart from the fact that you have written all these songs and continue to make albums. So do you ever stop yourself and say, yeah, that's kind of cool?
I can't get any relish from it. Intellectually, I can see that. And every week someone seems to do a new cover of it. Or when I try and get some satisfaction out of that, it doesn't work. I don't know why. The thing that I have is very restless. And as soon as I've kind of done something, I sort of lose interest in it. And I want to move on to the next thing. So it's the most synced Australian song of all time, apparently, or one of the most synced songs. But I just, I fail, it doesn't cheer me up. It doesn't make me sad either, but the thing you would imagine, I don't know, I'd be the guy who would win gold at the Olympics, and I'd sort of go back to my room and sit there and look at it and go, why isn't that making happy?
Yeah.
I don't know why it works that way. Maybe that's why I keep writing songs, because I'm looking for that one that I can, that will do the thing that I always hoped that this whole thing would do, being in a band and having, playing on stage and people clapping and people loving my song. All these things, it doesn't bring me what I wanted, which is a good thing, because then I'm never satisfied and I just keep on going.
Well, I'm going to follow up on that. So what brings you closest to what you want?
I don't know. I've had periods of my life where through meditation and yoga and exercise and love, I've felt I've synced up more to the universe. And at the moment, I feel like the universe has a purpose for me. I'm like Jonah on the boat running away from what old nasty old cranky pants Jehovah wanted him to do. And I feel like the universe has a plan for me, has always wanted to be so much more than I am. And that I feel like fooling around with rock and roll, but I've always felt connected to, when I say the universe, I mean God, but I'm not talking about a Christian God or a Muslim God, I'm talking about some ineffable, wonderful thing that's out there that loves all of us and has a purpose for all of us. I feel like my ego is always fucking around with me and diverting me from what I really want to do. So that's the kind of answer to that. I don't think writing Under the Milky Way is the be all and end all of what I could have done. I just feel like I could have done more. I want to do more. I want to help people. I want to help animals. I want to help the planet. I want to do the right thing. But it never, I don't know, I'm never really happy with what my contribution is. And when people go, oh, that's all right, you give loads of people happiness with your music. Once again, I try and embrace that idea and it slithers away without giving me that warmth and happiness that I feel I should have. So there you go.
Well, first of all, I personally think it's wonderful to have a restless mind and never be just resting. But again, I'm digressing because it's fascinating to hear this from you. But I totally get it. I get it. And
okay,
one of the words that you mentioned, because then there's a connection here between the two songs, Under the Milky Way and The Hypnagogue. I'm sure there are many connections, but there's an interesting one. And you use the word slither, and the song Reptile, which is another great song, is on the album Starfish, from which Under the Milky Way came.
Yeah.
And you use the word reptile again. You use it in, you say
reptilian base
in The Hypnagogue. And so there's something about slithering and reptiles that come to you. And just explain that before we get into Under the Milky Way.
I don't know how I make that connection, but it feels like it's sort of, maybe the bass line in Reptile itself is like a snaky bass line. That's probably the best example I could think of. It sort of doesn't do, you know, I hate, you know, talking about bass, that's a whole other can of worms. But I hate this idea of bass, of a guy going boom, 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 boom. I hate sort of like... But what I like is when the bass is really inventive and counter what everything else is doing. And in that song, Reptile, I think that was really the epitome of that. Interestingly enough, there's a book. I've written a book about the Hypnagogue. And in the book, the guy, when he's under the influence of the drug that's pulling all the songs out of his head, he's standing before the tree in the Garden of Eden, and instead of a snake, there is a six-string bass in tree playing music. It's all kind of mixed up in my mind. Everything's all floating around, but I definitely see really good bass playing as being snaky, for sure.
Interesting.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
So let's get into Under the Milky Way and how this is now your first album as The Church. And first, your name was slightly different. It was Church of Man is what I believe. And then you shortened it, right?
It was never called The Church of Man. There's a line on a David Bowie record, The Church of Man Love. It's such a holy place to be. It's Moon Age Daydream, is it?
Yeah.
And I thought that was... That's the first time I started thinking about the church, the idea of the church. But the band was never called The Church of Man.
I see.
But it's kind of, that's where it's all coming from, this idea of a sort of a rock and roll church or people gathering together. When I was a kid and I would go and see music or I'd listen to music, the music that I liked most had a kind of a spiritual feeling to it. And that's still my favorite music. Music that's sort of implying more. I'm not interested in music about drinking and fighting and, you know, all that rock and roll malarkey. When the Beatles started smoking pot and taking acid and they started writing songs like Strawberry Fields Forever, that's when my ears really pricked up. And I felt like this spiritual... And when Brian Wilson... from the Beach Boys, Teenage Symphonies to God. He said that in an interview once. I could really relate to that. The church was sort of supposed to imply when you come and see us, there's a kind of a spiritual, there hopefully will be a spiritual aspect to this.
Yeah. Well, look, there's definitely, you feel it with the music. And like I said, I've known your music for a long time and you continue to feel it with the music that you're making today. So, your first album was 1980 as the band. And then...
Yeah. It came out in 1981. Yeah.
And then you get now, you have album 2, 3, 4. And so tell us just a little bit about your journey that... And then you come to Starfish with Under the Milky Way is on Starfish. But tell us a little bit about, you know, your state of mind going into the studio, like where you were as a person or as a band or as an artist going into the studio and where that was, because that's pretty interesting too. It was a different turn for you.
The first album was successful. The second album was even more successful. The third album wasn't very successful. Nobody really liked it that much. And then the fourth album was Heyday, I really wrote the first three albums pretty much on my own. And it's credited on the record. You can see the other guys sort of help out a bit, but it was mainly me. On Heyday, I said, let's open this up and let's get, you know, you guys better guitarists than I am. That's why I'm the bass player. So it's all silly that I'm writing all this stuff. I know you guys are capable of helping me write this. And they were. So on Heyday, which was the album before Starfish, we wrote all the songs together. However, there was always this thing that I know, sort of an unspoken thing. If I come up with something on my own that's good for the church, it's all silly if we don't use it. So when Heyday, who we were signed to Warner Brothers, when Heyday, well, that was a huge critical success. It only sold 180,000 copies. I'm saying that in a sort of facetious way, but that's the truth. It only sold 180,000 copies, and Warner Brothers dropped us. Arista Records contacted our manager and went, we want to sign him up. We're going to give him a good budget, but we don't want them in Australia goofing off. We want them to come to LA where we, well, we want, you know, look, all our records of that were made in Sydney. And I guess a new record company would go, we want them to come here and we want them to keep an eye on what they're actually doing. In the meantime, I had a little home studio that had now turned into an 8-track. And I had written this song, Under the Milky Way, and I did a really nice little demo of it. But it's in a particularly lithic period when, you know, unlike most people, I'd sort of have my dinner and then I'd go in my studio and I was enjoying seeing how many songs I could write. And Under the Milky Way was just a song I wrote one week. And I kind of wrote it with my then girlfriend, who ended up being the mother of my first set of twins, a Swedish lady called Corin Jansson. She's a sort of the co-writer on that song. And I put it on a cassette. I didn't think anything more of it, and I assumed it was like on Starfish, we kind of had an agreement. Everyone would have one song that they wrote, and then the rest would be songs what we would write together. And the song that I wrote on my own was a song called Hotel Room, which was the last song on the album, which was a pretty bloody good song, I thought. And the others, nobody, it's like when I turned up with that song, I'd come along and say, here's the cassette, and I'd put the cassette in. And when they heard that, when they heard Hotel Room, everyone went, well, okay, that's definitely beyond the album. However, I had this manager. We'd had the manager for a while. He was an American guy. He was also the manager of Waddy Wachtel, who was one of the producers, Waddy Wachtel was like a guitarist de jure who played with Keith Richards. He plays on all of Stevie Nicks' records. And him and this guy, Greg Ladani, were going to be the producers. I made a demo of Under the Milky Way and put it on a cassette with about, I don't know, 10 other songs. The manager heard the cassette and he said, this song has to be on the album. And he went to Waddy Wachtel and he said, this song has to be on the album. I don't care what else happens with this album, that song's got to be on there. And I was like, fair enough. And the rest of the band like, yeah, okay. When we got to America, they didn't really, we played a live version of it. We were sort of worked up a live version. They didn't really like it. So I went in this MIDI studio and recorded it with a guy, as opposed to, so that there was this big studio called The Complex that's no longer there. It was a state-of-the-art studio. And my song that had to go on the record because the manager was saying it has to go on the record. They didn't want to record it as a live song. So I went in there and sort of recreated the demo of it to a certain extent, including another example of the randomness of music. I was going to write something really good for the middle, which is now the bagpipe solo. I was actually going to come up with some beautiful classical thing. I just had these sort of chords. And the guy that I was doing the record with in the MIDI studio said, what's going to go in here? I said, I don't know. What have you got? Like, let's just put something funny in there to make the guys in the control room laugh. And he had this instrument called a synclavier, which meant you could, anything can do this now, but back in 1987, this synclavier could play samples very easily of anything else. And he had a library of samples, and there was a sample of an African bagpipe, and he played it and it was like, oh, I said, that's hilarious. Not that an African bagpipe is hilarious in itself, but no, I don't think any instrument is hilarious in of itself, and I don't have any cultural imperialism towards that. But to think that it was going in this song, which, I don't know, wasn't really sort of, it was just a complete juxtaposition. And then I said, yeah, put it in backwards, because it was easy to, you know, you could easily hear things backwards. So it sounded, and then put a couple of them, So there's this thing going in the middle. I thought, man, they're going to really think that's funny when they hear that. And then the two big shots, Waddy and Greg, the producers, they really liked it. And they were going, hey, you finally, you know, this is really good. And I'm going, no, that's a joke. And they're going, no, 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 we really like this. We really like this. We finished the song. The producers decided that our drummer didn't have the right feeling. And they got in this guy, Russ Kunkel. And he played the song on these pads. And I didn't really have much to do with this. I watched him do it. And they were kind of right. He had a really nice feeling. I don't think the song would have sounded the same if it had been recorded live with a live drummer and stuff. And so it was recorded sort of to a click track, bit by bit by bit. It was never a live performance. The stupid backwards African bagpipes were left in. The guitarist, Peter Coppice, then did some Ebos, which is this thing you put on a guitar and you get infinite sustain. He put an Evo solo over the top of all that, and they mixed it all up. And finally, this veteran drummer, Russ Kunkel, came in, and he played drum pads. And then there it was. It was finished. And I didn't like it as much as Hotel Womb. No way. I thought Hotel Womb is a really cool song. I thought it was okay. When Waddy Wachtel and I were sequencing the album, there was a lot of revisionism after the song became a hit. Everybody was like, oh, I knew that right from the word go.
Of course, absolutely.
Of course, I didn't. And I remember sitting there with Waddy Wachtel and we had the 10 songs that were going to be on the album. And I had the idea the album was going to start with Destination. And the second song would be Milky Way. And there's a link between them. The Destination is also a lyric in Milky Way. And I remember sitting there with Waddy Wachtel and saying, I want Under the Milky Way as a second song. And he wanted to bury it. And he's going, you don't want people hearing that song so soon. I was like, why? And he was like, oh, you know, it's not the strongest song on the album. I think we should put it on, you know, in like on vinyl, there was this sort of this position where you buried the track somewhere on the track, the fillers. You buried him on track two. So anyway, I kind of insisted. I said, no, thematically, it needs to be the second track because the first track is going to be Destination. And then this track comes on. They're sort of in the same key. This is the way I want it. And reluctantly, they went along with that. Okay. Meanwhile, this other guy, Greg Ladani, the other producer, was threatening that Marty's song was going to be the single. And he was saying, it's going to be Spark and you better get used to it. And I was like, please, no, God, don't let it be. Please, that cannot be our single. It was all sorted out one night. Clive Davis and his entourage, who'd signed us up, finally came in the studio and said, play me some music. And we played him Destination and we played him Spark and we played him Hotel Womb. And he was like, yeah, 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 good, good, good. Then we played and finally someone said, here's one, you might as well hear for the hell of it. When that was over, he said, okay, I've heard enough. And he came over to me and said, congratulations, that is a hit. And then as he walked out, all of his minions, one by one, in ranking, in their pecking order, went, that's a hit, that's a hit, that's a hit. And then they went back. And it was a hit, but they made it so. They put everything they had into making it a hit, and it was a hit. They never believed in anything as much again to put their full weight. But for a while, we had that entire record company all around America were making sure that song was going to be a hit.
It's very remarkable when you think about it. So it was in so many times when there's the storytelling about how the songs came to life, the bagpipe part of your story is so remarkable because it it was almost accidental. The way that you talk about it, it was almost accidental, almost like a joke. And yet that is such a magical part of the song. And
yeah.
And it's so it's like the serendipity. And this is when you start talking about like the spirituality that you were talking about. Like, you know, who knows where the vibes come
from? It's because, you know what? It was because we didn't care. When you really care about, like, if you care about something too much, you can lose sight of what it is. Like a golfer. A golfer standing there, he's got this big shot. If he can get it in, he's going to win the whole thing. Yeah. You need to detach. And I was so freaking detached from that song, from that session, from those producers. I was totally detached. And so in a spirit of detachment, it's like, yeah, put a bloody back. If I really had thought, oh my God, this is my chance to have a big hit single. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I probably would have blown it.
Yeah.
But the fact that I didn't care, and nobody else seemed to freaking care either about that song, allowed it to turn into what it was without anybody meddling in it too much. Nobody had much opinion about what it should do. And so I pretty much just followed my demo. We haven't talked about how I wrote it yet either, have we?
No. Yeah, exactly. I want to hear about how it all came to you. From the moment of first inspiration that you remember, like,
I do. Okay. This is a true story. Once again, it shows you how random everything is. Me and the Swedish lady were at my mother's. My mother had like a house up the coast where she lived with her husband. After dinner one night, I knew if I could disappear, I wouldn't have to do the drying up with my mother. My mother's favorite thing was after dinner, she'd wash up and then she'd have what she would like a natter, where you'd have to stand there and dry up the dishes. And she'd go, you remember Mrs. Ferguson? All her lumbago's playing up so badly, son. I don't know what she's got. You know, and you go, yes, mum. And then you're standing there drying up the dishes while my mum has a little natter about her world. I thought if I run away, Corinne, the Swedish girl, she'll have to do the drying up, and it won't be me. Because she was Swedish and my mum was English, Corinne could speak really good English, but my mother was talking in, you know, like this Cockney from London, is talking about things that Corinne had no idea. You know what I mean? Like, so Corinne would just stand there and go, yes, very interesting. Yeah. Meanwhile, I ran away, I smoked a joint, and in the garage was one of my brother. My brother had put a piano in the garage of this sort of holiday home. And I went out and I smoked a joint and I started fiddling around with this chord progression. Corinne came out after drying up and went, so yeah, nice that you left me with your mum, and ran away. But wow, this is really nice what you're working on. And I went, yeah. We sort of fiddled around with a melody and I put some words to it. She put in some words and it was on the piano. The bass line just sounded good. But when I got it home the next week and I said, I'm going to do a demo of this song, and the top line of the piano became an acoustic 12-string guitar and the bass line actually became a bass guitar, suddenly it had, even though it was the same thing that had happened on the piano, when it was transferred to two different instruments, when the bass guitar comes in and plays the second note, which is an F sharp against an A suspended fourth or something, it really does something different than it did on the piano. So when I made my demo, it had a whole other feeling. It's still a nice song to play on the piano, but when it's split up into an acoustic guitar and a bass guitar playing that, what formerly was just on the piano, it had a whole other feeling. So that's how it sort of got written. And then I made a demo of it with bass and guitar and electric guitar and did the singing and did all that and put it on a cassette. And it sat on that cassette until one day the manager listened to all these songs and he went, that's the song you guys have got to have on the album. And nobody thought any more of it than that. Clive Davis anointed it. And then from that moment on, everybody was like, oh yeah, we always knew that was going to be the single, with the power of Arista behind it and all the extraordinary lengths they went to. I still have journalists go, I was one of the journalists Arista took to an observatory. They hired observatories all over America. And when they would unleash the album, especially Under the Milky Way, you were sitting in an observatory and all the seats tilted back and the heavens opened up and the journalists found themselves looking at the sky. All of these things, they pulled out absolutely every stop. It all became... That sounds pretty good to me.
That sounds pretty good to me.
It poured out of you. It sounds like when you were in, you got away from drying the dishes, that it poured out of you really quickly, that it came together very quickly.
Yeah. I sat down and it was just lucky where my... See, this is the thing about me. I'm better at this than almost anyone I've ever met. I spot the potential in things really quickly. Someone else might have played those notes and those chords and they might have just moved on. But for me, after I sat there and played this little chord progression, I could see it was a powerful chord progression. I immediately, you know, this all would have taken like 3 minutes. And by the time she walked out, I had the chord progression together. And she was like, wow, that's really nice chord progression. And sort of encouraged me, you know, she said, really got something good here. Let's write some words. So, you know, it was all over within 10 minutes, the words, the music, everything.
Then this song becomes a signature part of Donnie Darko. You were talking about Sinks before as an example.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, because we can't get into it too much, but what was your reaction when you heard it and integrated into the movie Donnie Darko, which has become such a cult classic?
People told me it was being used and I had no idea what, you know, Donnie Darko was. And I went along one night and watched it. And when it came on, I was thrilled. I thought, wow, it's in this really great movie. I'm glad it was used in this incredibly fantastic left of center movie. I was very, very happy. When it came on, it was so loud in the cinema. I sort of slunk down into my chair, almost embarrassed, like, whoa, gee, I hope nobody sees me sitting here listening to my song because up so loud. It had been used a lot before that. It'd been used in Miami Vice, but it seemed like that was sort of like the second coming of that song. Yeah. And that aroused a load of interest. And after that movie was a big hit, I think it gained more traction. I was delighted that the song was used in such a hip and wonderful and iconic movie. Very, very happy. Very happy indeed.
Yeah, great movie. So thanks for taking us through the journey of that. Let's get into the Hypnagogue a little bit, because we go from the fifth album, and then there's a lot of living in between.
A lot of living in between
until we get to...
Five children.
Yes, exactly.
I had five children. I had 10 years wandering in the wilderness being a heroin addict, something it seemed I had to go through. I was a junkie for 10 years, and then... by the grace of the universe, one day it's sort of like a jailer. It sort of came to me and went, okay, that's it. It's over. And I was released from that bondage. I kept making music and making records. I didn't stop, but I made music despite the heroin, not because of it. In the very beginning, I had a little honeymoon period where it really increased my productivity. And the Church made one of their very best albums called Pre-Sequels Aura. And unlike other drugs, I took the drugs so I could get into a state that I wanted to recreate with music. And this had really worked well for me with pot, and still does. I smoke marijuana and then it puts me in a groovy place from which I can create music. I got to say it. I mean, this is like heresy. And people will probably, if they're still with us, will be angry. But for a little while, heroin and opium, I got my hands on some opium, really facilitated my songwriting, and it really put me in this sort of deep and wonderful, warm place, and I wanted to recreate that with music. Of course, after a little while, that all ended, and I just became another stupid junkie who couldn't do anything at all unless I could scrape up a couple of $100 and then go out and find it. And then for 10 years, I made music despite that. Probably wasn't the best 10 years of music I ever made. And then I stopped, and then...
Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but not... I didn't stop because I'm a wonderful, strong, incredible person. I started because I was an idiot, and I stopped in the same stupid way. I sort of slid into it like a fool, and then I luckily got off the hook like a fool.
But number of, many people don't come
they
back
don't.
From
no.
it.
No. So
there's a,
lucky.
There's a strength to doing that, and that brought you... You were making music the entire time.
No, I was.
You were able to shake that. And then, the pandemic hits. We get to 2023 where you release new album, which is...
And also, you're overlooking something else. All of the two guitarists, one left in 2013 and one left in 2018. So I now, coming in to make the Hypnagogue, I had two brand new members in the band. One was Jeffrey Kane, who was from Remy Zero, a big American band who'd been a fan of The Church.
Yeah, I like Remy Zero a lot.
He had toured with us a bit, and he's very instrumental in the Hypnagogue. And we had another guy, an Australian, if you're putting a band together in Australia, he'd be one of the guitarists you'd get, like a guitar swinger for hire who can play anything or anything. He joined the band as well, a guy called Ash Naylor. And we had Ian Hogue, who was in one of Australia's biggest bands called Powderfinger. And he'd been with us after Marty left. Marty and Peter, by this stage, none of us were getting on very well. It was a relief for me. I won't dwell on this, but I was very relieved when they were both gone. So, the pandemic... We started making this album, pandemic hit and shut down the album. Nothing was happening. You weren't supposed to leave where you were. You were allowed to, in Australia, you were allowed to leave your home for work. Mm-hmm. And I figured, if fucking making a record isn't my work, I don't know what is. So I boldly took to the streets and booked some time in a studio on my own to finish the record, because we couldn't all do it together. Meantime, Jeffrey Kane had gotten his hands on a very insignificant piece of music that we'd been fooling around with before the pandemic hit, and he had recontextualized it, and he had cut it up, and he'd played bass on it himself, and he'd cut it all up and sent it back to me. And so when I sat down and listened to it, I didn't even know where this had come from. But he had just taken a very ordinary thing, cutting it all up and putting it back together, had created this wonderful piece of music. And same process. And this is where in this song, I discovered that this album is going to be a concept album. And it is the story of the guy using the Hypnagogue. That's what the lyrics are all about.
And the Hypnagogue, explain to everybody what the Hypnagogue is.
Okay. The Hypnagogue is a futuristic thing. It's a place. It's like a factory. And we're talking a future in 2054, 100 years after I was born. And it all came together bit by bit. The story started writing itself. There's a woman in Korea has created this thing, and it works in a very dangerous way. It delves into your life and your past lives and your dreams. It delves into your very soul and finds music and songs that you didn't think you had within you. And it works on, and there is a novel, I wrote the novel, I fleshed it all out. It works on drugs and sex and magic and this kind of very bad technology that imagining in 2054 that sort of there aren't many spare parts. So she sort of fashions this thing, this machine, this event that can drag the music out of your head, not just out of your thoughts, not just out of your dreams, but out of your past lives. And in the novel, we see this, we see how this works, how he goes in, he climbs into this tank, and then the thing starts probing his mind, and it's like music from all of his lifetimes, and it starts dragging the songs out. The only trouble is the music is so potent and the process is so dangerous, and that it's bad for the person that it happens to, and it's also the music is dangerous for the people who listen to it, because it's sort of like, it's really music that no one should ever hear. It sort of has an occult quality to it. And we find out in the novel, the other people who have used the hypnagogue, they all end up in a graveyard because it sort of drives them crazy. And we also find out that the people who have been listening to the music, who are listening to it too much, because all the music that this scientist has developed with the hypnagogue, it's all become number ones. But then we find out that the people who've been listening to it too much all kind of are driven crazy and sort of have strokes and mental breakdowns, because this is music that should never have been accessed, not recombined in such a way. It's sort of inexorable music. It's like if you hear it, everybody who hears it would fall in love with it, because it's the mixture of the very best stuff that should never have been all mixed up. But it almost sounds like The Ring, when you're watching The Ring, you know, that movie The Ring, where somebody's watching the television screen and then it sucks you in. And the hypnagogue is doing a similar thing, but with beauty. And I'll tell you, it's a dystopian story that you're laying out there. But for everybody who's out there, I've listened to the album several times. It's a beautiful album. And if you're most familiar with Under the Milky Way or that era of the Church, you'll love this album. It's a beautiful album.
Thank you.
No, it's and it was fun to discover it. So I enjoyed that.
Yep.
But
yeah,
listen, I want to go through a couple of things and then let you go, because I've kept you. But you have so many things. We talked about the album. That album was 2023. You just recently released the companion album, Arrow Zeta, and the Perfume Guitar.
Yep.
And then my understanding is that you're going to be reissuing your first four albums on vinyl very soon, and then touring will kick off in Australia at the end of the year.
Yeah. The first four albums are being re-released, remastered. It seemed that would be a good opportunity to do a tour. So we're doing a tour. We are on the verge of signing a deal with somebody who's going to re-release all our albums. They're very hard to find. You can stream them all. They're all up for streaming, but to find like the vinyl and even the CD versions could cost you hundreds and hundreds of dollars on eBay. So we are in the process with different record companies of re-releasing everything. So eventually you'll be able to get it all again. It will all become available. But in Australia, Universal are re-releasing the first four albums, you know, with deluxe gatefold and colored vinyl and all the stuff you would imagine that they're going to have. And yes, we are doing a tour and we're going to play big chunks of those first four albums with the new band, because there's nobody in the band anymore except me that made those albums.
Well, and rumor has it also that you're going to be doing some shows in the Maldives next year, and that sounds pretty good to me.
That sounds
really good to me.
It does. Some people who've done that have sort of said to me, a great, beautiful island, but don't expect the technology to be what you might expect. So
well, I'm
sure. Ready for anything.
If it's coconut. If it's a show,
yes. If it's a show on the beach with bongos and coconuts, I'm just as happy with that as, you know, playing with a great big PA and all the bells and whistles. So whatever that is, yes, I'm looking forward to that. But
at this stage of the game, I have no idea what that will be and what to expect, but I'm happy with whatever it is.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a wonderful time. So listen, Steve Kilby, wonderful to have you on the Story Behind
Thank
the Song.
Thank you for having me.
No, I really enjoyed
this. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it too. I really have. And you're a very good interviewer and very patient with all our stuff. And the questions you ask and have been very, I don't know, I've really enjoyed it. And you haven't kept me at all. This has been a very, it's actually cheered me up a bit. So thank you very much for this. I really enjoyed it.
That was Steve Kilby of the great Aussie band The Church telling the story behind the band's classic timeless track, Under the Milky Way. I'm your host, Peter Chadi of Deep Cuts Media. Thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song, and stay tuned each Monday for another episode of new interviews mixed with classic interviews of icons like Debbie Harry of Blondie, Rick Astley, Boy George, and Brandon Flowers of The Killers. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to the list. And make sure to like, subscribe, and share the show itself and revisit all of my great 40-plus interviews. The artists are legendary, and their stories are classic and timeless. And one more thing, check out our Story Behind the Song merch on the Consequence website. If you like the artwork for my podcast, you'll love the poster. You really will. It's beautiful. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.